From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, American Hauntings. But here's what's happening. A new study, and this is an amazing story, a new study says children living near the Fukushima nuclear meltdown plant have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer at a rate of 20 to 50 times that of children elsewhere, a difference the authors contend undermines the government's position that more cases have been discovered in the area only because of stringent monitoring. Most of the 370,000 children in the Fukushima area have been given ultrasound checkups since the March 2011 meltdowns at the tsunami-ravaged plant. The most recent statistics released in August show that thyroid cancer is suspected or confirmed in 137 of those children, a number that rose by 25 from a year earlier. A simple blood test that predicts whether a patient with chest pain will go on to have a heart attack could save millions and prevent hundreds of thousands of people being admitted to the hospital. Scientists at the University of Edinburgh have discovered that the level of a protein in the blood can indicate whether a patient will suffer a life-threatening heart attack or not. Four Russian cruise missiles fired at Syria from the Caspian Sea apparently landed in Iran. It was unclear whether the missiles caused any damage. On Wednesday, Russia said it fired 26 missiles at 11 targets in north and northwest Syria. That was about 930 miles away. But today, it reiterated that all the rockets hit their targets. Chris Geo has his finger on the pulse of geopolitical affairs. Chris, I want to get your take on just what you think is going on in Syria these days.
Well, things are definitely falling apart, George. Russia seems to be doing in a week what the United States hasn't been able to do in 3 years, and that's take out this whole ISIL organization. About 40% of their infrastructure is gone. But really, when you think about it and go back to the beginning of this ISIS creation, it's really the Free Syrian Army who we were funding, dropping weapons on, and dropping bombs of cash upon in order to try to take out Assad. Now, it's all starting to crumble because the United States is starting to realize that Russia is exposing the paper trail that's been going all up and down the line. The world is starting to wake up and see this as well. So I've been looking into the situation with the missiles going into Syria and actually falling in Iran, and it looks like American forces are actually using EMP weapons to bring those missiles down so they can turn around and say, look, Russia is trying to bomb Syria and all the missiles are landing in Iran. It's really all starting to fall apart, and people are starting to wake up and see things for the deception that it really is. And I think the hallmark of a true patriot, George, is the ideologies of freedom. And people are starting to challenge the government and challenge the talking points of what the government is really all about. And as true patriots, we're standing up and saying, no, we're not going to take this anymore. Imagine what would happen if everybody in the world all of a sudden stopped referring to themselves as American or Muslims or Christians or any of that and just started referring to themselves as people. All of this would stop because people don't want to hurt people. It's the ideologies that we've been brainwashed to believe that make us want to hurt each other, and that's what I think is really at the root of all of these ISIS fighters and Muslim extremists. It's the ideology that they've been brainwashed with.
Well, you know, you along with Craig Hewlett both have the same feelings about how this all started. Chris, thank you. Well, amid persistent rumors that fugitive Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman has put a $100 million bounty for the death or capture of Donald Trump, a former New York City Police Department commissioner is warning the Republican presidential candidate, hey, don't take this threat lightly. Trump earned the ire of Guzman over the summer while he was still in prison when the real estate mogul and candidate made his now infamous remarks about Mexican immigrants. He said during his campaign speech that Mexico sends its criminals and rapists to the U.S. Now, Guzman escaped, and now apparently he's got a bounty on the head of Donald Trump. Let's check in with Frosty Wooldridge, who's written a book called America on the Brink. That's a scary story for Trump. He's got to take that seriously, Frosty.
Yes, George, it's a pleasure. He certainly does have to take it seriously because That man down there in Mexico obviously escaped, but you know that the escape and the arrest were all set up. And he has so much money that he could literally hire mechanics. And we now know, of course, that snipers can take anybody out at 1,000 yards, 1,000 meters quite easily. So hopefully Trump has a tremendous protection around him 24/7 because he certainly is a target.
You can track Frosty's website on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Legendary chef Paul Prudhomme dies at the age of 75. The superstar chef from Louisiana, known for popularizing authentic Cajun and Creole cuisine around the world, has died at the age of 75. What a chef he was. A representative from Prudhomme's restaurant, K. Paul's Louisiana Kitchen, confirmed his death. Representatives said the chef died after a brief illness. A Saudi woman could face defamation charges and up to 1 year in jail there for posting a video of her husband groping his housemaid. The wife caught her husband flirting with a maid in their kitchen in that Gulf Kingdom and secretly videoed the incident with her cell phone. She then posted the video on social media with the caption, "The minimum punishment for this husband is to scandalize him." Well, looks like they're going to go after her and put her away for up to a year. The New Horizons mission has returned the first color image of Pluto's atmospheric hazes and shows them to have a blue tinge. It's amazing. You can see that story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. And they're also saying Pluto has ice water. You're going to find that water is in abundance throughout the universe. And, you know, for decades, observers have talked about the overview effect, the feeling of global connectedness that astronauts get when they see the wide Earth below, devoid of national boundaries. Now, one of those astronauts said it's possible to get the overview effect and translate it into action without even going into space. Retired astronaut Ron Guerin, the author of The Orbital Perspective, he's counting on it, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Retired NASA astronaut Ron Guerin served aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery and spent 6 months on the International Space Station. He has traveled 71 million miles and change in 2,842 orbits of our planet during more than 178 days in space. Now, he holds the distinction of being the first person to give a TED Talk from space. Now a global humanitarian, social entrepreneur, he has founded the Mana Energy Foundation, Fragile Oasis, and Spaceship Earth Grants, among other not-for-profit enterprises. He's on Coast to Coast tonight. We're going to talk about his work, The Orbital Perspective, and lots to talk with him about. Ron, this is a pleasure. Thanks for coming on tonight.
Hi, George. Really looking forward to our discussion.
And by the way, you got a birthday coming up in a couple weeks, I hear.
I do. Yet another one.
Almost born on Halloween, huh?
Yeah, that's
that, program. That was close. You know, all of us, when we were kids, wanted to be astronauts. Not all of us were able to do that. Were you the same way?
I was, yeah. Ever since July 20th, 1969.
What was it about space that got you so excited, Ron?
Well, I think one of my most vivid childhood memories was on that day, July 20th, 1969, where, along with, you know, millions and millions of people around the world, I watched that first moon landing.
Yeah.
And, you know, even as a little kid, what really struck me was that we were a species no longer confined to our planet. And the excitement of the exploration of, you know, what's beyond was really something that motivated me throughout my whole life. And it was a long journey, but it was something that I always, you know, had in the back of my mind that, you know, if it was possible, I was gonna try my best to join the ranks of those explorers and be a part of the space program.
I mean, how exciting! I remember as a teenager, I was watching Walter Cronkite that day, watching Neil Armstrong come down from the ladder, and I just could never forget it. One of the reasons I went into broadcasting, in a real quick, funny story, we used to make little model rockets when we were kids, and we launched them. And, you know, I would announce the launch to all the neighborhood kids, and my buddy Gary Frank, he would be the one to put the little engine in the rocket and put the batteries to it, light it, and off it would go. Well, I end up going into broadcasting. Gary helped build the engines to the space shuttle that helped take you up there. It was a just small world.
It is.
And then, I got to know Edgar Mitchell from Apollo 14, so it's great to have you on the program as well. When you were, and you've been in space a couple times, you were on STS-48 that went up there in 2008. You were on the International Space Station in 2011. What's it like, Ron, looking back at the planet when you're floating around in a rocket ship or a space station?
Well, it took me a couple hundred pages of explanation to explain that. But I know we have 2 hours, so maybe...
Yeah, you've got a lot of time.
No. Well, I mean, it really is a transformative experience. And, the first time I looked out the window and I looked back at our planet, the first thing that struck me was the thinness of the atmosphere. And I've heard almost every astronaut that has flown in space say the same thing. And, I saw hundreds and hundreds of pictures of the Earth before I flew in space. Every astronaut would comment on how thin the atmosphere was. So I had it wasn't a surprise to me. It wasn't, I had this expectation that it was going to be really thin, but until I actually saw it with my own eyes, it really was very, very sobering to think that little thin, paper thin line is the only thing that keeps every living thing on the planet alive. And that was, I think, my first recollection of looking back at the planet from space.
Did you have that wow factor when you were looking back?
Yeah, the other thing that hits you is the indescribable beauty of our planet. It is just this jewel, and what struck me was this idea of a fragile oasis. It really does look like a fragile oasis out in this vastness of nothingness, and it really looks very, very special, and it looks like something that we should take care of.
Does it look, you were pretty close to the planet, of course, not like those who went to the moon, but it's still, to me, when you look at Google Maps and things, as big as the planet is, it's still small, especially with our technology today.
Right, especially when you're going around it every 90 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
We are significantly closer. We're only about 240, 250 miles away. That's our altitude above the surface of the Earth. But it's high enough to give us, if you let your eyes adjust on the nighttime side of the orbit, you could really get this feeling that you're looking at a planet hanging in the blackness of space. Or, like I said, if you're on the dark side and you let your eyes adjust, a planet hanging in the vastness of infinity as the Milky Way comes out. And it's really an incredible experience.
You were on the ISS for quite a long time. Do those days go by fast or slow for you?
Some go by faster than others, but we're, it costs a lot of money for us to be up there. So, rightfully so, we are trying to get every second of time accounted for and made useful and, all the scientific experiments we're doing up there. So the days up there are extremely busy. But there are moments where you could just kind of take a break and look out the window and think about the Earth and all those people on it, and those are really profound moments.
Yeah, they sure are. Did you have a chance yet to see the movie The Martian?
I did. I did see it last week.
Yeah, I went last week, too, and I thought Matt Damon did a great job. And
he did.
Something like that could happen one day, couldn't it?
What, going to Mars? Or
just getting stuck on Mars like that.
I hope not. I mean, of course it could happen. I hope it doesn't happen.
The technology that we're working on, Ron, today, if you turn it into, where things will be at in 10 years from now, and then I look back with the technology that we used to get to the moon and how far we've progressed since, and we haven't gone back yet, I mean, are we going to be able to do some incredible things? I mean, technologically, we've done incredible things now. I mean, we've gone to Pluto. We're doing amazing things. But how much more can we do?
Well, when you look at things from a purely technical point of view, I don't think that gives you the complete picture. Because if you were to extrapolate, I think like you were hinting at, if we were to extrapolate space exploration, for instance, from the Apollo days, from 1969 onward, we would have been exploring outside the solar system by now, and we haven't even been back to the moon yet. So the technology has to be matched with political will, with cultural will, with resources. And so, you know, there's no limits to what we can do technically. You know, people ask me when I think we will go and explore Mars, and the answer is 10 to 15 years after we decide to go.
Yeah.
If we don't decide to go, and by deciding to go, I mean we've allocated the necessary resources to do that, resources and finances. And so you have to, in order to answer that question, you have to bring in basically the political sphere as well. And that's a little bit hard to predict.
We're with retired astronaut Ron Guerin. We're talking about his work, The Orbital Perspective, but the subtitle is important. Lessons in Seeing the Big Picture from a Journey of 71 Million Miles. So you come back to the planet, and things have changed for you because you have become an entrepreneur, but you have been involved in social and humanitarian things now, Ron, more than just about anybody I have seen, at least in your field. What happened to get you to do that? I mean, have you always been that generous in your time and your efforts to change the planet? Or did being out there change it?
Yeah, I don't think that I had a really abrupt, radical shift in my worldview. It's kind of funny when I put it that way, because it was a difference in worldview. But I mean, from a political point of view, worldview. From going to space. I had founded the Mana Energy Foundation actually before I flew in space for the first time. But what going to space did, I think, was reinforce those beliefs, you know, especially the belief that we all have a responsibility to leave this place a little bit better than we found it. So I think I launched with that belief, but I think what seeing the planet from space and seeing the reality of the home that we live in from that vantage point, from that perspective, really reinforced those beliefs and principles that I launched with.
You know, you were an F-16 pilot. You flew combat missions in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And when you're up there in space and you look at this vastness of this incredible, beautiful planet, it's almost hard to imagine that when you look at the planet from space and you see the oceans and clouds and the land masses, to think that there are little tiny human beings down there killing themselves like crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's I kind of call that a sobering contradiction, the contradiction between the beauty of our planet on one hand and the unfortunate realities of life on our planet on the other hand. And there's a lot of times, there's a lot of moments while I was up there for those 6 months where that really hit home. One was I took this picture of the Mediterranean one day, and it was a beautiful picture. I really loved it. You know, it had the dark blues of the Mediterranean against the light tans and reds of northern Africa, you know, with the curvature of the earth and the thinness of the atmosphere. But framed in that picture was Libya. And I took that picture on the day that Tripoli fell in the Libyan Civil War. And so if you look at this beautiful picture and then you zoom into the microscopic details of what's happening on the ground, you see that the picture's not as beautiful as it looks.
No.
And so that reality, that sobering contradiction, is a big part of what I call the orbital perspective. It's this, you know, this shift in the vantage point of seeing our planet, and to see that, you know, most of these conflicts are people fighting in a small sliver of an apparent paradise. And the other thing that really hits you, which is related to what we're talking about, I guess, is the other realization is that each and every one of us is riding through the universe together on this spaceship that we call Earth, that we're all brothers and sisters, that we're all in this together, and it's a very dangerous environment out there, and we need to pull together in order to make sure that we're going to, you know, keep the species
going. Oh, absolutely.
The living things on our planet going.
I would wish every politician would get your book and read it, Ron.
I do too.
My gosh. Hey, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back with Ronald Guerin. We're talking about his work, The Orbital Perspective. And he's so right. My gosh, there's so many great things about this planet. Yet we're going to destroy ourselves if we don't stop and take what he has said in The Orbital Perspective, learn some lessons. We'll be back in a moment. Some of you are calling now. We'll take your calls next hour with Ron Guerin. We're talking about his work, The Orbital Perspective. I'm afraid, Ron, if we don't follow through and listen to many of the things you point out in that book, that we could be headed for disaster on this planet. How much time do you think we have?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but you know, if you look at, imagine a graph where, you know, one line is sloping down, and that's basically the destruction that we're causing to our planet. But there's another line that's crossing it, that's sloping up, and that's the increase in our technological ability to solve those problems. And technical and political will to solve those problems, and where they cross is hopefully before we hit the cliff. But the problem is we don't know where that cliff is. So, but there's hope in this whole story, in that we are changing as a global community. We're changing both technologically, culturally, politically. And there are trends that are developing that I think can give us all some hope.
I think so, too. I've always wanted to write a movie about astronauts on the ISS from different countries, different political persuasions in those countries. And then war breaks out on the planet between all the countries that they're all from, and they're up in the ISS in, you know, enjoying what they're doing. They're friends. They care about each other. Yet on the planet, everybody's killing each other. And I wonder what really would happen if that really did occur.
Well, I mean, I'd like to think that I know what would happen, because, you know, we're not too far from that right now. And, you know, when we're up on the International Space Station, it's not the Russian guys and the Japanese guys and the whoever else. It's the crew. I mean, we're one crew working together, and that really supersedes everything else. And it's funny that you mentioned a movie, because I'm actually working on a movie right now. It's called Orbital. It's not going to be a fictional thing like you mentioned, but it is. Kind of the goal of the film is to take the collaboration that built and sustains the International Space Station and bring it down to Earth and put it into the context of our rapidly developing, hyper-interconnected global society. And when you do that, there are some really interesting things that make themselves clear. You know, we're going to be filming all around the world, and we're going to be interviewing astronauts from every country practically that has flown in space. It's going to, I think, really kind of meet that objective that you talked about in the movie that you'd like to make.
Yeah. Do you find that young children, when they find out you're an astronaut, just go wild?
Yeah, you can see the eyes light up. And it doesn't matter where the children. I spoke to children in an orphanage in rural Rwanda about the space program, or in one of the townships in South Africa, and that same wonder and awe in the eyes of the kids is apparent wherever it is. The same curious questions and intelligent, probing questions about this really, really unique experience I find all around the world.
That's fascinating. What do you think of extraterrestrial life? Do you think we're alone in this vast universe, or that maybe there could be other intelligent life forms out there?
Well, do you want the real answer, or do you want the answer that I gave TMZ when I got ambushed?
I want it from your heart. I want the real answer.
So, I mean, the real answer is, we have a really huge, incomprehensibly huge universe. We're discovering more and more planets outside of our solar system. I forget the latest number, but it's a lot.
Vast,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, one end of the spectrum is that the universe is teeming with life, and including intelligent life. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is we're the only place that the miracle of life has ever occurred in this vast universe, and anything is possible on either ends of the spectrum, or anything in between. We don't know this yet, but just from a mathematical, statistical view of the universe, I would be somewhat surprised if there wasn't life somewhere else in the universe. But I don't go so far to say that they visit us regularly and they work in the local grocery store and
yeah.
They're planning our demise.
Which is interesting, Ron, because Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, though he has told me, he says, George, I've never seen anything. I mean, I didn't see any ETs when I was on the moon, and I haven't seen him now. But I've been told by a lot of people in government that this is real, that that they're out there, and they've been visiting, and they take off, and, we may have been seeded from them. And to hear that from an astronaut, as you, I mean, if you had said that, I'd go, oh, my God, then this is really happening. But it's an interesting take. It's enlightening to hear that, and it's also somewhat puzzling.
Well, I've worked for 30 years in the U.S. government, and I've never, at the highest security levels, I've never heard anything like that. And what to me is the biggest thing that makes me doubt it is I can't imagine that secret being able to be kept. So that just seems like too big of a secret.
If it's a secret, boy, they're doing a great job with it, that's for sure. But you're also very spiritual, aren't you?
Well, I suppose yes, depending on what you mean by that. But I do, you know, I do believe in God, and I believe that we have a place in this universe, and everything that goes along with that.
Yeah, me too. Something that I think just keeps pushing me to try to get some answers of just this vastness. I'm convinced, not being a scientist by any means, that the primordial soup out there in the universe is the same everywhere. So you're going to get a lot of planets that have, you know, similar composition, water, same minerals, same elements. I think it's all over the universe, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the conditions for life probably exist, you know, in many, many different places.
So with orbital,
I'm more concerned though with what we do with the life on this planet.
Exactly.
At the moment,
that's your mission, right?
If we don't do something about it, we may never find out what else is out there.
There's this distinction between, and you've witnessed it, the haves and the have-nots. I mean, by going to Africa, for example, you've seen the distinction between people who are in poverty, people who don't have what so many other people have. That gap can't continue to widen, or we're really going to be in trouble. What do we do as people to get these governmental leaders to realize that we got to stop fighting and we got to start building a planet that takes care of people? How are we going to convince them?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that really gnawed on me when I was in space, and even before I was in space, and certainly when I come back, is the injustice that exists when you look at our planet. You know, the fact that 5,000 children die every day from waterborne diseases that is completely preventable. Name your woe. We have so many woes around the planet, which is bad enough as it is. But what makes it even worse is the fact that a vast majority of these things are completely easily solvable. And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, you know, how do we get our national leaders to fix these problems? I think one of the things that we need to realize is we don't necessarily need the national leaders and the politicians to fix the problems. The average citizen has been empowered beyond belief through the technology, the interconnected technology, the collaborative technology that exists on our planet. And that particular technology is exploding. And one of the things, you know, I think one of the big paradigm shifts, if you will, not to borrow a buzzword, but is the way we look at those people, the way we look at the people who, you know, if there's a natural disaster or a drought and a famine, and we think, oh, those poor people over there. Well, I think that's the disconnect. The disconnect is that's not those poor people over there. That's us. We're all in this together. And I think that little shift right there could do a tremendous amount. And the other thing is, you know, I believe that the vast majority of the people in the world want to make a difference. They want to help fix those problems. But I think one of the things that prevents people from making a difference is simply that they don't think that they can. They
right.
think that the problems are too big, that what could one person possibly do?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways, the analogies that I use to describe this fallacy really is an asteroid. And if an asteroid was coming to hit the planet, and it was a big one, and it was big enough to wipe out every living thing on the planet and cause this massive extinction event, if we knew about it soon enough, you know, we wouldn't have to send Bruce Willis and the whole team out to blow it out of the sky. We could simply send a small spacecraft and with the force of a feather just nudge the trajectory of this asteroid enough that it would equate to hundreds or thousands of miles of miss distance. And so when we zoom out to what I call the orbital perspective and we look at that big picture and we look at it over a long, long time frame, not tomorrow, but you know, a long time frame, we realize that each and every one of us is incredibly powerful to nudge the trajectory of our global society in a way that puts us on a much more positive path. And so I think, you know, those couple of small things, I think, would go a long way to helping us solve those problems.
Somehow, and you're absolutely right, we've got to be able to take the greed factor out of this, because I think that's the reason so much hatred and bitterness and wars occur on this planet, because of greed, whether they want, you know, oil reserves or what these people want. But I got to tell you, we really should send your book to all these people, corporate leaders, all of them.
Well, I mean, I think greed is a big part of it, but I also think ignorance is a big part of it, too. And I think I heard one of your earlier guests comment on this. It's, you know, the label, we tend to oversimplify things, and we tend to lump groups and countries and cultures and races into these cubbyholes. And we built this, like, framework to view our planet. And I think the reason why we do this is we do live in a very complex, complicated world. You know, our world is filled with lots of horrors. You know, there's terrorism and disaster and famine and poverty and all these terrible things. But there's also ingenuity and creativity and love and generosity and selflessness. And so to make sense of this really complicated world, we tend to build these frameworks. And in the process of building this framework to view the world through, we tend to place these groups and organizations and countries into the cubbyholes. And by doing that, what that does is it separates us from each other. It separates us from the potential solutions to the problems that we face together. It's a really dysfunctional and very counterproductive way to look at the world. And so greed plays a big part in a lot of the conflict. But I think another major factor is simply this oversimplification of current events. It's this oversimplification of an us. It's an us versus them, two-dimensional mentality about the world. It's a flat world syndrome, where, well, guess what, when you go to space, it becomes obvious that we don't live in a two-dimensional world, that we live in a very beautiful, very complicated, complex world that needs to be. So if you're going to solve the problems facing our world, you have to see the world as it really is.
When you left NASA, did you leave with the intent of doing these projects that you're doing now?
I did. I left in October of 2013, and you know, I left my dream job, the job that I worked my entire life to get, because I felt a really burning responsibility and obligation to share this perspective and to do it in a way that was unimpeded by being an employee of the United States government. And so, pretty much everything that I've done since I left NASA, whether it's the startups that I'm involved with, the book that I wrote, the movies that I'm writing, I started painting and doing artwork. Everything has the overriding goal to communicate this perspective of our planet that I believe can if embraced, can really change the trajectory of our global society.
If you had that magic wand and you were able just to wipe it clean, what would be some of the first things you'd do or change?
The first thing I would do is I would somehow open people's eyes to this fallacy that any one organization, any one nation can achieve the type of real change that we need in the time frame that we need it. That I would open decision makers' eyes to the reality that we really do need each other. And you know, one of the things to think about is we have, I think, about 2 billion people on this planet that are not connected to the internet.
Right.
I think it's more than that.
More than that.
Yeah, much more than that. And so these, you know, there's a lot of efforts to try and connect everybody to the internet. And one of the reasons why I think we do that is if we had 7 billion creative problem-solving minds connected to the global conversation through the internet, we'll find solutions we never dreamed of coming from places we've never heard of. And so it's not just, a nice thing to give people the internet so they could surf the internet. It's a way to get people involved, get those closest to some of these problems involved in the global conversation, so that we can be, you know, that's true innovation, is to get these different perspectives. Because if you have different people with different perspectives looking at the same problem, sometimes the solution becomes crystal clear.
They estimate 4 billion people, almost 60%, still aren't connected to the internet. Can you imagine that? 4 billion people. They have no idea how to use it, what's out there, or anything else.
But that's changing fast. If you go back, 25 years ago, How many people were connected to the internet?
None of us were on it.
You know, that's another big tenet of the orbital perspective, is that nothing is impossible. That, you know, because we tend to believe that things that have never been done before are impossible. And I think that's a, you know, what that equates to, though, is that we do not have to accept that the way things are, the way things have to be. We don't have to accept the status quo on our planet. We have the capability, we have the resources, we have the technology to shape the planet, shape the world that we live in.
We have taken a personal pilgrimage on this program, Ron, to get our power grid insulated because I'm concerned, and so many others are, that a EMP, electromagnetic pulse, a nuke detonated in the atmosphere, or a huge X flare from the sun could simply wipe us out. You had protocol procedures when you were on the ISS that if you got blasted with an X flare, didn't you folks have to run into a special secure area or something?
Not really. There is no shelter on the space station. There are places on the space station that just naturally have better shielding against a radiation event. And actually, water is a really good insulator for radiation. So, we normally store bags of water, mm-hmm. large bags of water throughout the space station, and usually in the same place. And so, you know, that would probably be a good place to go camp out for a little while if there was that sort of event.
How big is the ISS compared to a football field?
Yeah, it's bigger than a football field.
Wow.
I think if somebody was claustrophobic, they probably wouldn't be too claustrophobic on a space station. It's a big place.
That is something else. Well, we're going to take some phone calls next hour with you as we continue talking about your work. And the orbital perspective is available all over the place right now, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Pick it up then. I want to talk with you more about your movie. Could you call it a documentary or strictly a movie?
Yeah, it's going to be a full-length feature documentary. And I'm working with these amazing filmmakers. Their first film that they made is called Overview. It got 7+ million hits or views on Vimeo.
Oh, that's huge.
And you opened up talking about the Overview effect. It's basically a 19-minute documentary about the Overview effect, about that shift in perspective that some astronauts communicate when they come back after seeing the planet from space and in space. The second movie they made was a full-length feature documentary called Planetary. It just debuted at South by Southwest. It won all kinds of awards. It's an unbelievably beautiful cinematic masterpiece that basically frames some of the problems that we've been talking about and putting it in the big picture perspective. And then, so we're teaming up to make the third of these films, which is, again, going to be a full-length feature documentary filmed in 6K, you know, super HD, lots of aerial and space footage. It's going to be a really beautiful, beautiful film depicting a lot of the things that we're talking about.
Well, when they're done with our millions of listeners, let me know and we'll put links up for you, okay?
You bet.
Make sure everybody can find that. Absolutely. We're going to come back. We're going to take some phone calls with Ron Guerin. By the way, he's on Facebook. He's on Twitter. He's got it all. So just go to his website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And just, you know, follow him on Facebook and like him on Facebook and do what you do with social networking because it is huge. And we'll be back. There's some more questions, of course, on his work, The Orbital Perspective, and we'll take your calls. And by the looks of things, you better start calling early because we're not going to have many lines left. If you need to reach me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. And, of course, you know the website, coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment with former astronaut Ron Guerin, whose birthday is coming up in a couple weeks. We'll be back.